Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
You know, Joe, I've long held a fascination with underground transit systems.
Oh, yeah? I like them, too.
Yeah, I mean,
they're a totally unique space.
They are, and it's... You know, and it's one of those things. I grew up in more of a rural environment, and then later in my life moved into urban environments where I actually have had access to these various underground train systems, and have traveled to places, such as New York and London, where they have the most famous examples of the underground transit system. But it, no matter where I am in that timeline, they're always just as fascinating to me, whether they're something that I only see in a horror movie or something that is a part of my day-to-day life, just getting to and from work.
They are such a unique environment and such a cool thing. I'm the same way. I'm kind of fascinated with them so I made it this far in my life without ever going to New York until this past year. Mm-hmm. Went to New York for the first time. And when I came back, like, the main thing I wanted to talk to everybody about was the subway.
I know.
Yeah. I was like, it's amazing. There's stations everywhere. You know, just around the corner, you can go right in, get to wherever you're going. This is how a city should work.
Yeah. And it's also one of those cases where you grow up watching all these movies. It's such a location, a fitting location for not only, you know, horror and monsters and mutants and chuds, but also just intrigue, like interesting characters going places, and they do so by traversing the underworld.
Yeah. Who's that woman in the overcoat with the collar up at the other end of the station? Did she just look at me? What's going on? Am I being followed? But yeah, I like that you mentioned the chuds, because that is another aspect of what's great about subway systems, generally any underground transportation. Are there other underground? I said that as if there's like underground buses or canals. I'm not sure if there are. But so the underground trains, the tunnels, the tube, all this stuff. When you go down into these spaces, you're literally entering a subworld.
Yeah.
Where there is a whole infrastructure. There's like a city under the city, and in many of the big stations, there are things in the stations underneath the city. Right. It's not just like the train comes by, but there's like little shops and counters and stuff like that. And it's this whole other world that's divorced from the sun. It's separated by this solid barrier, And it's this alien environment where it seems like unnatural things could happen.
Yeah, it's a true underworld. Myth cycles around the world for ages have had tales of underworlds and people that live underground, races that live underground. And it wasn't until relatively modern times that we made that truly possible. And they still have the mythic allure that they had, back when they were just a dream.
So is that what we're going to be talking about today? Morlocks?
Well, in a sense, because we are going to bring this back around to science. We are going to talk about the question, what if a species becomes trapped in the underworld? What happens over time? Can it become a different species altogether? Can it become a subspecies? And we have one very interesting example of that occurring.
All right. Well, one of the ways we know you can create a new species or a new subspecies is to significantly alter the environment in which you live, right? Mm-hmm. And so this, I guess, is why we're emphasizing this alien world quality to our unnatural underground systems.
Yeah, indeed. And it's something that, again, we've continued to read into it. We create these worlds, and then when we stand back and we say, wow, this is really strange what we've done here with this completely artificial environment underground. And countless writers and dreamers, filmmakers have taken that and explored that territory. Two examples that come to mind are Robert Barber Johnson's short story Far Below, which is about ghouls in the tunnels beneath New York City.
Wait, when is that written?
That was like a weird tale, like a classic weird tale story. I can't remember the publication date offhand, but it's like, classic 20th century American weird fiction. Yeah.
Cool.
So that's a great one if anyone wants to check that out. And then if anyone out there, and I'm sure a lot of you are, fans of Neil Gaiman's work, he has explored this as well, the idea that the London Underground specifically is a gateway to a mystical fairy world.
Yeah, why wouldn't it be?
Yeah. And, a lot of this spills over into reality, too, in interesting ways. The author Peter Ackroyd has a wonderful book about London titled London, A Biography. And he points out several different, just really weird, fascinating facts about the London Underground. Mm-hmm. This is one of my favorite quotes that I always think about when I think about the tube. He says, "It is a strange city beneath the ground, perhaps best exemplified by worn manhole covers, which instead of reading self-locking, spell out Elf King." Which is great. I can't shake that image of like looking down. Here's this man-made portal into the underworld, and it says Elf King. Like it literally, names it spells out the dominion of this ancient fairy lord that's surely ruling over everything down below.
I thought of just one more reason why subway tunnels are so intriguing. It's because you travel through them, but you don't get to explore them. You can't go on foot.
Yeah, all you can do is look out. That's one of the things I love about traveling by underground train is you look out and inevitably there's like a forking tunnel or there's some sort of strange door or work area or
what's that?
Yeah, what is that? That space off to the left here. Mm-hmm. And then you read about things such as ghost stations, of which there are several in London. There are a few in New York.
And what is that?
It's a station that just isn't used anymore, just an empty station. And these occur with any train system also above the ground, but just the idea of going through this old place occupied now only by ghosts and maybe fading posters, it's just so rich.
Or maybe some insect Morlocks.
It's true.
We'll get to that.
Now, one film in particular that comes to mind on this topic is a 1972 film by the name of Deathline. And in the U.S., it came out under the title Raw Meat. And it's an interesting film. It's about a family of cannibals, mm-hmm, descended from Victorian railway workers who wind up buried alive in the tunnels beneath London. And I know that sounds incredible, but believe it or not, the best part of the film, or at least as far as I'm concerned, is that Donald Pleasance is in it, and he plays, instead of playing like a stuffy academic or some sort of nefarious egghead, as he was wont to do, he plays a blue-collar police inspector named Inspector Calhoun.
I don't believe you.
You've got to check it out.
Pleasance as blue-collar? Yeah. He goes and gets a pint of beer at the pub?
There's there's an extended sequence in which he and his friend go and get a beer at the pub, and it seems to go on for a very long time. And I don't remember how it connects really to the plot of the film. But at the time it felt as if the director was saying, hey, this guy's more interesting than all this cannibal stuff. Let's just follow him for a while. And then we'll come back to the weird cannibal dude.
But with that voice, barkeep, another pint of ale.
Obviously, he doesn't talk like that. That's one of the wonderful things about this. It's this more lively presence, more lively than pretty much anything else I've seen him in.
Okay. But he's not an underground cannibal.
No, he's just the police inspector.
All right. So where do the underground cannibals come in?
Well, it's the Victorian workers, the guys,
right.
The people who got trapped underground. They have turned into a different subspecies of human down there. And essentially they look like cavemen. So they haven't gone full the descent here and turned into more ghoulish characters. But there's basically one of these guys left. He's this shaggy caveman of a dude. And he just goes about kind of oozing from sores and growling and screaming and then attacking people and eating people.
So if this is from Victorian times, obviously this would not be enough time or enough generations to produce a true human subspecies adapted to underground tunnels,
right,
to produce cannibalistic Morlocks. Since Victorian times to the 1970s, what would you have had? A few generations.
Yeah. And to the movie's credit, yeah, they don't look like alien monsters. They look like shaggy humans, or the one that we see looks like a shaggy human. And, yeah, he goes about causing all this chaos, and it's a fair warning. It's a disturbingly violent film at times. It's a bit icky to watch.
So you're not necessarily saying go out and watch it?
Not necessarily. I mean, go watch the trailer. And if you can see a scene with Pleasance in it, and if, you know, dark, violent 70s horror is your thing, then do check it out. But I bring it up because this ties directly into the real world science we're talking about today. The question, if a creature is locked away, buried in the tubes beneath London, and it has time to undergo generation after generation of change and adaptation, can it become a different species? Can it become a subspecies? What happens when the dark underworld gets to do its work on natural world creatures?
All right, well, we should take a quick break, and when we come back, we will discuss the London underground mosquito.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, we're back. So the London Underground Mosquito is going to be what we're talking about today. You can probably guess from the name that it lives in the London Underground. So what's the deal with the London Underground, Robert?
Yeah, I suppose we should just back up a few steps and just talk about the tube itself.
The environment in which it dwells.
Indeed. This was the world's first underground railway, opening in 1863.
Man, that's early.
Yeah.
I would not have believed that.
It's grown and expanded significantly ever since then. And so today you got 11 lines collectively handle about 4.8 million passengers a day through 270 stations and 250 miles or 400 kilometers of track. Now, despite the name, it's worth keeping in mind that only 45% of that is actually underground. There's plenty of track that goes above ground, but still, that's a lot of underground track.
Okay, so the London Underground Mosquito, that's the London Underground part.
Mm-hmm.
Mosquito part.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about mosquitoes for a second. So,
what are they? Are they, is that some kind of elephant? I can't remember.
Well, it's interesting because the mosquito, we all know what the mosquito is. We all have a very close relationship with it. Or at least we have a very close relationship with a few types of mosquito. And that's key because the world is currently home to some 3,500 named species of mosquitoes. And of those 3,500, only 200 or so actually bother humans. We're kind of irresistible, right? Like the mosquito, we thrive with ease throughout most of the world, and we offer large expanses of relatively hairless skin, all of it coursing with delicious blood.
Oh, man, you don't usually think about hair as being such of a protective mechanism against parasitism like that. But yeah, I mean, like if you're a mosquito and you come up against something really hairy, that's almost like trying to get through barbed wire.
Yeah, and we're large organisms compared to, you know, most organisms. We're large, relatively hairless, and we're everywhere, and so the mosquito is everywhere. Now, the most common genera here are going to be the Anopheles, the Culex, and the Aedes mosquitoes. Now, mosquitoes obviously are accomplished flyers. And anyone who's ever tried to kill a mosquito can testify to this.
Right.
I had a tangent here when I was recently in Barbados. We largely didn't encounter mosquitoes at all, but we had the Zika virus on our minds, so we were always on the lookout. And I was trapped in the room by myself at one point with one mosquito.
Ugh.
And it seems like it took forever for me to kill it. I finally had to do that trick where you're like, all right, I'm gonna let you land on me. I'm gonna let I'm gonna let you feed or almost feed on me, and I'll do it just to protect my family from you. I'll offer myself up as a sacrifice, and then I will kill you. But that's often the only way you can get them. They're so surprisingly skilled at getting out of the way of our slaps and smacks.
Well, thanks for exposing me to Zika now, Robert.
Oh, it's all right. I was not infected. So maybe I killed it in
time.
That's
good to
hear. Or it was one of, not infected itself.
Well, you do hear about how these mosquito species can traverse these long distances that you wouldn't expect. In one of the things we were reading today, it was an excerpt from a book by a biologist named David Resnick, who we'll get into more detail about later. But he mentions the fact that, it used to be that Hawaii didn't have mosquitoes that would bite humans.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
They got imported. Not on purpose, I think. Wouldn't that be a great thing?
No, but they're like a lot of species. They have a tremendous ability to hitch rides on human transport. So they've managed to invade whole new continents, such as the invasive yellow fever carrying Aedes aegypti that you find in South America, which has been quite a problem. They also, other cool thing to keep in mind about mosquitoes is they benefit from an incredibly fast reproductive cycle.
Now, this is going to be important once we start talking about the rates of evolution.
That's right. Because for the rate of evolution to really be visible, you have to have short periods. You have short lifespans and fast reproduction cycle.
Yeah.
And, indeed, that's the case here. All they need is the tiniest bit of standing water. Abandoned swimming pools, bird baths are great, but they'll also do just fine with a pet bowl, even a candy wrapper, a small puddle of, or even just a damp spot in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
They go through four stages, adult water surface eggs, subsurface larvae that breathe through a kind of snorkel that pokes up through the surface of the water, and a pupa stage. Now, they've been around roughly 100 million years.
Isn't that great to think about? Well, actually, it's not all that unusual because we've all seen Jurassic Park. But had we not, wouldn't it be fascinating to think about these little insects biting dinosaurs?
Yeah. Just to think that this is something that they've been so good at for so long, and they're not going away. The oldest evidence we have for blood feeding mosquitoes comes from a fossil that's known as proto mosquito, and this is from the Triassic period, about 220 million years ago. So there were no flowering plants. So the elongated proboscis is thought to have functioned like modern mosquitoes, for the drinking of blood.
Oh, you mean, so it's like, since there weren't plants, it couldn't be like a hummingbird, sticking its nose into something. If it was sticking its nose into something, it was probably something that had blood in it.
Right. That's the theory. Now, you'll find mosquitoes now on every continent except Antarctica. They thrive, and even our most exhaustive steps to eradicate them often only work in the short term because, again, they're just so adept at moving into new environments, taking advantage of the smallest quantities of water.
Okay, so we've got the two things there, the London Underground, the mosquito. Let's make these great tastes taste nasty together.
Yeah, so first of all, let's talk about the surface mosquito before we talk about the, subsurface variant.
All right, so the species we're talking about is Culex pipiens. And according to biologist David Resnick, who I'll cite more deeply, especially toward the end of this episode, pipiens is the single most widespread mosquito in the world. It's all over the place. It is a disease vector known to spread West Nile virus, as well as some forms of encephalitis and meningitis. And it mates in these big swarms that take place out in open areas, and then it deposits its fertilized eggs in the form of a floating raft of eggs on still water. Resnick rather elegantly, I think, lists, quote, untended bird baths, forgotten buckets in the backyard, discarded automobile tires, clogged rain gutters, or wherever else fetid, stagnant water accumulates.
I love that.
One of my favorite words is fetid. It's just really good. Now, once these rafts of eggs start to hatch, they turn into, as you mentioned in the general mosquito life cycle earlier, the water-dwelling larva stage. And these larvae eat small things that live in the water, eat microbes for sustenance. And then about 10 days into the larval stage, they come out of the water as adults, begin feeding, and begin the breeding process. So the females seek out a blood meal, which in Culex pipiens almost always comes from a bird Why? Well, because bird blood is good stuff. Don't be a food snob at the Culex Pipiens. After you've got a blood meal from a bird, you've got enough nutrition to invest in forming some eggs. And this is important because it goes blood meal, then eggs. You need the blood in order to make the eggs. And then once you've got the eggs, you can start the whole process over again with a mating swarm, or what I think should be called a swargy.
Oh, I like that. Swargy. And it is worth noting the whole male-female mosquito thing here.
Right.
Because the females are the ones that feed on blood.
Yeah.
The males do not. And you're wondering, what do the males eat if they don't eat blood? Well, they feed on flowers and plants. Many a beautiful swamp orchid depends on mosquitoes for the pollination. So the blood is directly tied to the reproductive cycle of the female.
Right. So now in London, there appears to be a totally normal form of this species found on the surface, doing all the normal stuff, feeding on birds, getting the blood meal before reproducing. And that's standard Culex pipiens. Mm-hmm. But there also appears to be a subterranean variant of this species in the London Underground.
That's right. And Londoners supposedly first discovered them during the Blitz of World War II. So German bombers terrorized the night skies, and roughly 180,000 people sheltered in the tunnels, just as they had during World War I.
Can you imagine that? It's like you're fleeing bombing of your city, and the last thing you want is to be swarmed with mosquitoes in the dark.
I know, and that's what happened. They had to contend with not only mosquitoes, but apparently lice and ticks. And everyone knows about rats in the subways and sewers. To go back to my childish enthusiasm for underground transportation, I always get a little excited when I see a subway rat.
Yeah.
Even though I know you're not supposed to see one, and it's bad. It's an infectious rodent and all that. But I still get excited because it's like, it's like seeing a unicorn.
I don't know why. So I don't like to see a rat in my house, but when I see a rat scamper across the MARTA tracks, like, I love that feeling of seeing it dart out from cover and go to somewhere else. I'm like, yeah, go, buddy.
It's like that scene in The Last Unicorn. You remember at the beginning where the old man and the younger hunter glimpse the unicorn in the distance, and the old man like takes the kid aside and says, "You've seen something special today." There are not many of them left in the world. You know, that's how I feel about the subway rat.
Now, so you say people noticed these mosquitoes in the underground in World War II, but is that when they were first there, or were they there before then?
The mosquitoes or the people?
The mosquitoes.
Oh, okay. Because I do want to point out that World War I, you saw somewhere to the tune of a third of a million Londoners going down there. And there's a wonderful quote here that I ran across from Aykroyd's book, but he points out that Philip Ziegler in the book London at War related that, quote, "one of the principal fears of the authorities is that a deep shelter mentality might grow up and result in paralysis of the will among those who succumb to it. It was also suggested that the underground Londoners would grow hysterical with fear and would never surface to perform their duties."
So they were actually afraid of something sort of like the raw meat scenario.
Yeah.
Or death line, that people would go down there to take shelter and that they would just not be able to come back up.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note in looking at a film like Deathline, and it feeds into just sort of the industrial age paranoia of the English and really modern Western life. The idea that we're changing our world through this industrial movement. Our cities are becoming these inhuman places, and like the underground tunnel and the idea of cowering down there and, you know, protecting yourselves from these bombings, it becomes a perfect symbol of that.
Well, it is something worth thinking about because in a biological sense, our environments really do define us. They shape our very biology. You know, the way your hands are, the way your eyes work, the way your teeth are, and the way your brain defines your behavior, that's all shaped by the environment your ancestors come from.
Yeah.
You know, it's what genetic options the environment had to work with and then molding that to survive and reproduce best in it. So your environment does define you. I think that's not something to just be laughed off as paranoia.
No. And you know, there are also all these wonderful tales, you know, many probably folkloric in nature about, people known as firmers or rakers or flushers. These were people who cleaned sewage tunnel blocks, as well as toshers, who were hunters of valuables in the sewers and tunnels underneath London.
These are some great Britishisms.
Yeah.
Toshers, firmers.
So there are tales of like toshers and firmers becoming lost in this subworld maze. And eventually they either fall dead from exhaustion or they grow so weak that a swarm of rats just eats them alive.
Ugh.
So at any rate, the humans had been going down beneath London for some time. They had created this additional mythos and this and these various expressions of their fear regarding the underworld. And indeed, the mosquitoes had been down there for some time, too. Based on the research we're looking at, it seems that it's thought that you had different points when mosquitoes were introduced to this underground world, and then they become trapped down there. But since they have what they need down there, they manage to survive because there are rats. There are humans. It's where the humans go. You almost have this captive, ever-changing food supply.
Right. So, this does make us wonder. I mean, we should start to think about, you've got these mosquitoes that live underground. Mm-hmm. You've got the mosquitoes that live above ground. They appear to both be some form of Culex pipiens.
Right.
But are the ones underground actually a different animal now?
That is an excellent question. And after one more quick break, we shall explore it.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So after the war, no one forgot about the tunnels for sure, but I guess there was a lot else to worry about. People kind of forgot about the mosquitoes down in the tubes. You didn't see a lot of attention surrounding them. Occasionally, you know, there would be workers who would wind up with mosquito bites, and they'd report it. And certainly, you know, people who were going down there on a regular basis might have noticed them. Right. But for the most part, nobody really gave them much attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 50 years after the close of World War II, you had Catherine Byrne come around. Now, she was a doctoral student at the time, and she decided to investigate. So she collected mosquitoes from 7 different subterranean sites, and in all there were something like 20 sites covering outdoor, indoor, and subterranean locations around London. And then the researchers reared the captured mosquitoes. They attempted crossbreeding between mosquitoes and mosquitoes, not between mosquitoes and humans, just to go and get that out of the way. And they found that the Culex pipiens in the underground behaved rather differently from those that lived on the surface. So, for example, surface pipiens only drank the blood of birds. But this new subspecies, this Culex pipiens molestus, they call it, this one drank human blood.
Now, I got to make it worse than that. because to really excite your used needle squick, they feed primarily on humans and rats.
Yes. So, because what else are you going to feed on down there?
Yeah. So if you're down in the tube in London and you feel an itch on your neck, it's possible that the last thing that sharp little proboscis went into before your skin might have been another person, or it might have been the belly of one member of a huge cockney rat king.
that's a wonderful image. But yeah, that's always one of the concerns with a parasitic organism. Like, who else has it been feeding on and what else has it been feeding on?
Right. So there was a resulting paper here, right, published in the journal Heredity in 1999. It was a Burns paper with Richard Nickel, and it was called Culex pipiens in London Underground Tunnels, Differentiation Between Surface and Subterranean Populations.
All right, so let's talk about some of these differences that we see. So the core differences, of course, so we already mentioned that the mosquitoes are consuming primarily the blood of rats and humans because that is what's down there.
Mammal blood.
Yeah. Now, the other things to keep in mind is that the molestus mosquitoes, they don't need as much space anymore because they are living in confined tubes. And that is, that has an impact on how they reproduce because they're then not depending on these big, what did you call them? Swargies?
These big open air, open space swarming mating swarms.
Yeah. These big mating swarms are not occurring in the underworld. They are instead going with a smaller scale reproductive, venue, if you will. Yeah. And on top of that, they are largely protected from colder weather, so they forego winter hibernation.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, they don't need that blood meal necessarily to lay their eggs. Now, this is to say that, to get technical on the blood stuff, this means that they are autogenous. They do not require a blood meal in order to lay eggs. We already mentioned how the male and female mosquitoes consume nectar and plant juices. The females in the species just need that blood meal to energize their egg production.
Right. It's part of the reproductive cycle.
Right. And if you look at mosquitoes around the world, all the different species, some do require that blood meal, some don't, and some merely benefit from it, which is to say they can produce eggs without the blood meal. But if they get the blood meal, it's going to be that, much stronger of an egg production.
Yeah.
So in short, it appeared that the mosquitoes adapted to the underworld. They became so distinct even that they could no longer breed or would no longer breed with their surface dwelling kin. Different, and this is because different mating behaviors, different reproductive behavior, no mating swarms, just individual lovers finding each other in the subway tunnels.
Well, I guess this leads us to the question. Obviously, we've had since the beginning of the London Underground some form of divergent evolution going on here. But but does this count as a different species? That's sort of the question, especially a layperson might want to ask. Well, right. Is it really a different animal now? Is it a speciation event?
Yeah, because I think one of the big questions to consider is, you know, to what extent are they biologically and or behaviorally unable to breed with surface world mosquitoes of their species?
So this would be sort of the standard definition of a species division.
Right. Now, of course, that this is bearing in mind that distinct but closely related species can sometimes technically breed to produce hybrid offspring, though sometimes they're infertile or otherwise compromised.
Right. So I think now's a good time to take a look at a chapter from a book by the biologist David Resnick, who I mentioned earlier. And this book is called The Origin, Then and Now, An Interpretive Guide to the Origin of Species, that was published by Princeton University Press in 2011. And in a chapter on in this book, Resnick discusses the specific example of the London Underground mosquito and whether or not it is speciation and what this means for the concept of speciation. So a central question in biology, how long does it take for evolution to form a new species? How long should you have to wait?
Yeah.
Obviously, this could depend on a lot of different factors, right? You've got different mutation rates, maybe. If mutations are sort of providing the changes that lead to new body forms and stuff like that. You've got different selection pressures. You've got different rates of reproduction. You're probably more likely to see faster evolution in organisms that produce more generations in a short period of time, like we were mentioning earlier, like bacteria or even like insects like fruit flies and stuff, very quick turnover.
Yeah, I mean, that's why fruit flies, one of the reasons fruit flies are used so much in research, because you can watch this occur. And certainly when you find examples of evolution in action, so-called evolution in action, that's what you're looking at, species that have those really, really tight turnaround in reproduction.
But another thing that often leads to, speciation, at least as far as we think, is having highly specific different selection pressures, putting a group in isolation and then making it, very hard for that group to live except by one or two ways. And this tends to force adaptation to those new ways of life, which creates kind of a narrow adaptive bottleneck through which genes have to pass. So Resnick says in his book that he's not certain that these mosquitoes in the London Underground constitute a different species. But he argues that if they're not a distinct species, they're definitely on the way in that, quote, they have moved far down the path toward forming a reproductively isolated network of populations, which is the currently accepted definition of species. So that's going to what we said a minute ago, reproductive isolation. What we generally think of as a species is breeds with its own kind, doesn't breed with others. Mm-hmm. So let's review what we've said so far and add a few more things about our observations, about the difference between standard Culex pipiens and then the ones down in the tube. So like we said, surface Culex pipiens mate in these swarms in open areas. The subterranean ones mate in close, cramped conditions. You mentioned the winter hibernation. That's an interesting one because the surface pipiens have what's known as a seasonal diapause because, come on, I mean, they live all the way up in Britain.
Right.
Cold winter is not a good place for mosquitoes, so it gets really cold up there. During the cold weather months, pipiens stop mating. They build up a store of fat reserves, and they essentially hunker down to wait out the cold weather. Subterranean pipiens, they don't have winter to deal with. It's, you know, pretty much the same climate year round down there in the tubes, fairly warm. So they don't have this seasonal diapause anymore. They stay active all year. They stay breeding all year. They just keep going.
They're like a fine wine in a wine cellar. Hermetically sealed, yeah. And just kept at a constant temperature.
Aging, acquiring finesse.
Yeah.
biting rat kings and then
beautiful
biting
red liquid as well.
Yeah. So another one, we mentioned this before. Surface pipiens feed almost exclusively on bird blood, right? The subterranean pipiens don't have access to many birds for obvious reasons. Though this did make me think when we were talking about it earlier that it would be really cool to have a speciation event producing subterranean birds, like albino subterranean vultures that only live in, I don't know, subway tunnels or caves or something.
Oh, that'd be great. I guess the closest thing that comes to mind would be something like a kiwi, you know, that's kind of like a ground dwelling, like semi burrowing bird.
They burrow? I didn't know that.
Kiwis, if I remember correctly, you Kiwi experts can correct me on this, they do some sort of burrowing. Yeah. I mean, not like full blown, tremors burrowing, but, yeah. They dig around. Like they live very close to the soil.
Oh, well, what I want is bone white vultures with red eyes living exclusively in caves.
I could see it happening. I mean, I look fondly back on these different flightless prehistoric birds. So I like the idea of them returning in a subworld environment.
Okay, back to the pipiens. So surface pipiens, as we mentioned before, also remember they get a blood meal before they produce their eggs. You got to get some blood, then you lay your eggs. The subterranean ones, they can easily skip the meal if necessary. The question would be why? Why can they do that? Well, down in the tunnels, there is plenty to eat in the form of water-based microbial life that the larvae consume in their larval stage. The blood is more scarce. So if you can get through your life cycle on that, that's a good thing. Now back to Byrne and Nichols in 1999, as you mentioned. So we said earlier that there are other subterranean mosquitoes elsewhere in the world, right? Did we mention that? I think we did. The ones in the London Underground are not the only ones where mosquitoes are dwelling in some kind of underground space. But how can we tell whether these mosquitoes in the London Underground are A, subterranean mosquitoes imported from somewhere else in the world?
Mm.
You know, how,
cause we've already discussed how skilled they are at adapting to new environments,
right,
traveling with humans.
Or are they surface mosquitoes from London that moved underground and began to change? And this is where the genetic testing you alluded to earlier comes in. So you mentioned the mosquitoes collected from different sites throughout the underground and throughout the surface. They got mosquitoes from 7 sites throughout the underground network and then 12 different sites above the surface, like gardens and ponds. And what they wanted to look for was genetic variation at 20 different loci within the genes to see if the genes of the underground mosquitoes match the genes of the above ground ones, or if they've got these unique alleles that would be matching to underground mosquitoes from other places around the world. And what they found was that the underground mosquitoes in London did not have these unique alleles that were common to underground mosquitoes from other places. They had the same alleles as their above ground cousins in London. Another thing they found, interestingly, underground mosquitoes, maybe this isn't the correct term scientifically, but they're kind of inbred.
Well, that would make sense. And that comes back to Deathline. This is kind of an inbred, uneducated creature that's walking around.
Right. So there's relative homogeneity in the genes of the underground population compared to the surface. The ones on the surface have a lot more genetic diversity because they have a lot more different breeding options. Mm-hmm. The ones underground were sort of like, I don't know, you might think of them as like insect Baldwin brothers, you know, a little bit of variation between them, but not as much variation as you'd find within the general population.
Okay.
So this is also what you'd expect if you had a small population of original mosquitoes that moved into the underground and began breeding with each other and had just been breeding with each other and their descendants ever since. So what's the conclusion here? Well, it looks like a small handful of colonist mosquitoes from the surface made this plunge into the darkness sometime in the past, maybe very far back, maybe when the tunnels were first being dug.
Mm-hmm.
And they managed to survive long enough and to reproduce enough for the environment to begin to shape their biology. But then again, as we mentioned, is it a different species? This would really come down to the aspects of reproductive isolation. If they can't interbreed, we probably think it is a different species. And specifically, it's if they can't interbreed producing viable offspring down multiple generations, because some things might be able to interbreed and produce an offspring that itself can't breed.
Right. Yeah. And this is where we get into the various sterile hybrids that we see with other species.
Right. So what Byrne and Nichols found was that the underground mosquitoes could interbreed with one another and produce fertile offspring, but every time they tried to mate a female underground mosquito with a group of males from the surface, no eggs were produced. Underground females can mate successfully with underground males, but not usually with surface males. Resnick points out another really interesting thing from their research, which is how Byrne and Nichols also found evidence of mosquito colonists pushing the boundaries of habitat tolerance in both directions. So, for example, at the Oval Station in the underground, they found surface mosquitoes were trying to survive under the surface in a flooded tunnel at the bottom of an open shaft. They were trying to live underground, but they still – these surface mosquitoes trying to live underground still needed a blood meal to produce eggs, and they couldn't breed with the underground mosquitoes.
Okay.
Meanwhile, a colony of underground mosquitoes was discovered biting humans in houses in southeast London.
Huh.
So they were trying to migrate up and live on the surface, but they were genetically similar to the underground mosquitoes, and unfortunately for them – they don't know how to do this winter diapause, you know, the seasonal diapause. They can't hunker down for the cold weather. So when it comes along, it will smite them.
Huh. See, now this is an idea that isn't explored enough in our various weird fictions. Not the idea that there's some sort of an underground humanoid species, but the idea that the underground humanoid species then comes up and maybe tries, you know, they try to get jobs.
Yeah. They can't adapt.
They move into a flat and they just fail horribly because, of course, they're cannibalistic monsters.
Well, they will be used to a very, constant environmental condition to, you know, climate control, essentially, you know, caves are sort of climate controlled.
Yeah.
When they come up to the surface, summer and winter, it's going to be awful. They're going to be like, what is this water pouring out of my armpits? I hate it.
I guess in a way it's kind of the vampire myth as we often encounter it is kind of a play on this because you think of old Count Dracula.
Yeah.
Coming over to London, imported like a mosquito and then the hold of a ship.
Uh-huh.
Very limited in what he can do outside during the day. So maybe it has been explored, to ad nauseum already.
So the authors of the original study, they were careful not actually to get drawn into a big argument about whether the two populations are technically different species or not, but they were more focused on the process of speciation rather than trying to arbitrate the dividing line. But even if these two mosquitoes are not now separate species, they're clearly on the way there. So Resnick points out that this provides an example of reproductive isolation in many fewer generations than Darwin would have expected. And that's kind of interesting, right? You know, Darwin thought, well, you need maybe X many different generations to really produce a different species. But if we're almost there or already there with these mosquitoes, doesn't take nearly as long as Darwin would have guessed. But then again, keep in mind that these are mosquitoes, a very fast reproductive cycle. You know, they're insects. The same thing doesn't necessarily apply to oak trees or rhinoceroses.
Right. All right. So if reproductive isolation does happen this fast, why?
Well, Resnick has a couple of hypotheses in his chapter that I think are interesting. One of them is the idea of disruptive selection. And the way he explains this is that the survival requirements for the two environments, above ground and below ground, are so different that if you were to successfully mate a surface Pipiens with an underground Pipiens, its offspring would very likely have fatal deficiencies for either environment. What, you know, the traits you'd get from your mom would make you unable to live in dad's world, or the traits you'd get from your dad would make you unable to live in your mom's world. And so if it's on the surface, cold weather might kill it. If it's in the underground, it doesn't know how to hunt the right food. It can't put off the blood meal that it, you know, will have a hard time finding or something like that. And this prevents a kind of back interaction with the general population of the underground mosquitoes and enforces genetic isolation. But another way to possibly explain it would be changes in reproductive behavior. So what if these two populations have diverged in a way that specifically selected breeding behaviors that are incompatible? Think of the open area swarming versus the confined space breeding as just one example. They simply don't get down with the way the other population tends to mate, so mating doesn't happen, reinforcing reproductive isolation. And as far as I know, either of those are live options, or it could be a combination.
So something to keep in mind here, as Byrne points out in the paper, quote, the differences between Pippin's and Molestus forms seem to change from place to place within the range of the species. The ostensibly clear-cut distinction between the Molestus and Pippin's forms in northern Europe is not so apparent in the northern Mediterranean area and may disappear in some populations further south.
Yeah, and that makes sense because think about it. For example, one major difference between the London surface and the London Underground is the presence or absence of this cold weather diapause. If there are similar above and below ground populations in consistently warm climates, they're just less likely to have this difference, right? Because the surface mosquitoes don't need to become dormant for cold weather in a place where there is no cold weather.
Yes, that's a good point.
So Resnick discusses a few other interesting takeaways in his chapter. One is to simply cast a sort of doubt on the total relevance of distinctions between species. Like on one hand, it's very scientifically useful to have labels for things that are alike in order to separate them from things that they are unlike. And really that very notion is at the core of what science is, right? Categorization of similar things with one another. But it's also true that these boundaries are kind of porous and that the concept of a species does not actually operate in reality. In reality, there are things, there are genes, there are chromosomes, there are phenotypic traits, there are environments. A species is more kind of a concept. And Resnick writes, quote, species in nature should be thought of as fluid mosaics of populations that are becoming locally adapted, sometimes with the aid of similar adaptations attained by long extinct populations that adapted to similar environments. So a couple of interesting things there. One is this idea of species just being many individuals with genes that are always in flux. Things are coming and going. It's not a standard, totally defined thing with boundaries. It's just a family of resemblances. And then the other thing is that the last part about similar adaptations attained from long extinct populations. One thing that often appears to happen in cases of reproductive isolation is that some rare gene in the general population that doesn't seem to do much or provide much advantage suddenly becomes useful in a specific environment, and it becomes selected for and it gets pumped up and becomes more prevalent and comes to define the new population. And it's very possible that this gene was something that was useful to an ancestor of this current population. So it's like that you can adapt by pulling antiques out of the past when they suddenly become useful again. You might need that blunderbuss, not now, but sometime in the future.
Huh. Yeah, indeed. I mean, we see this in various experiments where they switch the epigenetic switch to say, make chickens a little more like dinosaurs again. Tweaking some one aspect of their anatomy, because that option is still there, like the options in a video game, should it need to be turned on. And hopefully I didn't anthropomorphize evolution too much for some of our listeners there.
Oh, we just got a complaint about that.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's unavoidable.
But I think that was also from somebody who didn't believe in evolution. So.
Huh. Okay. They said they didn't think we went far enough. All right. Well, on that note, we ask you, did we go too far? Did we not go far enough? But more importantly, I'd love to hear from anybody who, shares our love for underground transit systems. I'd love to hear from anyone who's ever been bitten by a London Underground mosquito.
Yeah. Did you feel the proboscis?
Yeah.
Of the Molestus?
Or, you know, it'd be great if anyone's listening to this podcast on the train, in the London Underground, if they are bitten by a mosquito during this podcast, I think that would be a pretty magical moment as well.
This magic moment.
All right. Well, on that note, hey, if you want to check out more information on this topic, go to the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. It should be up there nice and bright on the banner. And you'll also find all the links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, and Twitter. And hey, if you are a Twitter user, take part in this whole tripod initiative. Use the hashtag tripod with a Y to just suggest your favorite podcast, the podcast that fill your life with a little joy as you traverse the subway and deal with rats and mosquitoes or what have you. For my own part, I'm a big fan of Ideas with Paul Kennedy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's a wonderful Canadian radio show podcast that explores a number of tremendous philosophical, scientific, artistic, historic topics. It varies from week to week.
Well, why don't you tell us what podcast you out there like? So if you want to get in touch with us directly, you can email us as always at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.